Welcome back to the 20-Minute VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and I want to dive straight into the episode today because naturally it would be improper for me to have favourite guests to have on the show, but this is one of my favourite guests for sure. His career and thinking inspired so much of my journey, and it's just such a pleasure to welcome back Peter Fenton to the hot seat today. Now, Peter is a general partner at Benchmark, one of the great venture firms of the last three decades, with a portfolio including the likes of Snap, Twitter, eBay, New Relic, Stitch Fix, and many more. As for Peter, he's led deals, sat on the board, or sits on the board of Elastic, New Relic, Digits, Docker, Optimizely, Yelp, and Zuora, to name a few. Prior to Benchmark, Peter was a general partner at Excel Partners in San Francisco, and as a result of his incredible track, Peter's been on the Forbes Midas list more times than I've done podcast episodes. This was such a joy to do. But before we move into the show today, I have to say I just love using AngelList's fund admin platform to manage my investments. The team and platform at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of amazing products there with AngelList, last month I had Jeff Seibert and Wayne Chang on the show from Digits. Simply put, they're two of the best founders I've met, and they're creating the most intuitive financial software you've ever used, automatically analyzing your company's spend and visualizing it for you as it happens. Hone in on recent activities, trends, anomalies, or any question you have in just a few clicks. And unlike every other financial software, their integration is not weeks, it is just a few clicks. I have to say the product is just beautiful and you have to check it out, and so you can do that on digits.com. And finally, I've always been a big history man, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com, check out CooleyGo.com also. But enough from me, so now I'm thrilled to hand over to Peter Fenton, general partner at Benchmark.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Peter, this is such a joy to do. I've wanted to do this ever since our first episode, so thank you so much for joining me once again.
It's my pleasure to be here. You do great work, so we're all flattered when we get the invitation.
That is very, very kind of you, and I very much appreciate that. But I want to start today really with a focus on the origin story as we unpack the Series A that you led for New Relic way back in 2008 now. So let's start with the story and some history. And I heard that it all originated on a golf course, so I'm going to let you take it from there. What was the story, Peter, from that golf course moment?
Yeah, it is embarrassing in a way because I don't dislike golf, but I'm no good at it. And it's exceedingly unlikely you'll ever find me on a golf course. So the fact that that isn't the origin of this company is sort of hilarious to me and a little bit embarrassing. So Lou, I had known since 98, 99, when I was at Stanford, I'd met him and was fortunate enough to back him at Wiley, where he was the CEO of a generation prior to New Relic application performance management product. Wiley had sold to Computer Associates, and Lou was sufficiently enjoying his time off, which led him to invite me to play golf with him. And so we're both not very good. Now, Lou's better than me and doesn't stop the fact that about halfway through the golf round, we start to drink. Maybe two or three beers in, could have been more. He starts to share with me his ideas about a new company. And one of the things that Lou had earned after Wiley was economic freedom. So he didn't need to have investors. He didn't need to have a board. And Lou was positively giddy about Ruby on Rails. He had a sense of sort of like butterflies in the stomach excitement about starting a new company in this new area. And with sort of a Cheshire Cat grin, he said, and I don't need a board and I don't need investors. And so I had another probably beer and contemplated my relevance in this universe and then challenged him. And I said, listen, Lou, I guess you don't need investors and a board, but that doesn't change how hard you're going to work, in the sense that once you start a business and you're working on it, you don't work more or less hard based on the investor base or the governance structure. Perhaps you should reconsider that decision because the scale of your impact, I think, will be significantly lower without a broader ecosystem of support behind you. And then that led to the ultimate conversations about creating a corporate structure versus just doing this as a proprietorship. And I think we use the analogy. I said, there's plenty of people who run businesses like car washes and parking lots that don't need investors and don't need boards. But if you really think about what you're building here in its ambitions, why would you ever want to fall short of global scale? In which case, you're going to want the best people, and the best people are going to want to work for a company that's going to create the best equity value. And we represent a commitment to doing that work. I don't know that I convinced him, but certainly at that point, he said, you know, you raise a good point. And part of where I think we separated out the anxiety from an investor standpoint was trusting the partner and feeling like they have your back. And he and I had at that point, you know, a 7+ year relationship. So I think he felt like he'd have that with me. And that in a way, I think allowed him to feel safe in that commitment, as opposed to stressed about the anxiety of taking on investors and having a board.
Carlos, how do you think about creating that environment of safety and trust with the entrepreneur? You know, I've spoken to many of your founders before, and, you know, founders that you're on the boards of. How do you think about creating that environment of true trust and safety with your founders, which is so important?
It's the question in any durable relationship in the venture business, which is, can you be vulnerable with your principal advisors and counselors? And a board represents a governance structure. And so there are many people who, like myself, are highly anti-authoritarian. If we see authority, we immediately don't trust it. And so that's one of the challenges, that you create a structure that has the superstructure of mistrust, because this entity, the board, can do bad things. And I really relate to that question as a matter of human connection, where my relationship with Lou had gone through many phases, including him stepping down as the CEO of Wiley and recruiting a new CEO. And I think trust is principally expressed through each side being willing to have a measure of vulnerability. Yeah. And vulnerability is well documented. Brene Brown and others have done great work to document its efficacy in building relationships. But when I work with my founders, I want to make sure that that vulnerability is not only tolerated, but it's critically important as the fabric of our connection. And sharing bad news with me should feel like it doesn't get met with judgment and condemnation, but rather validation of the bad feelings that sometimes come with it, but then a constructive partner who's there to say, okay, what are we going to do about it? So a big part of any relationship when it goes south, in my experience, is that vulnerability gets shut down and trust evaporates. And then you end up in a dynamic where it feels like metal on metal. So by over-investing at the beginning in vulnerability, allowing for the bad news to carry just as much space for compassion, good feelings, bad feelings, all those things, because bad news typically is a catalyst to learning. One other variable that I quote that I've used a lot recently is the Jeff Bezos comment, which is, whenever there's a mistake or you do something and it's a failure, it's tuition. You know, you've paid either in time or money, resources to learn something. And if you take that mindset that bad news is a catalyst to learn and get better, I think the founder-investor relationship has a fabric of a mutuality to it that is essential to nurture.
Totally with you in terms of the importance of nurturing. And what a partner you've been to New Relic over the last year, 12 to 13 years now. And when we look back, 2008, observability was not the most obvious and attractive in spaces, but it is definitely today. And, you know, when I look back at our last episode, PC, you said, I'm always amused by VCs that say they look for big markets. And so I'd love to hear, kind of projecting your mind back to 2008, when doing the deal for New Relic, how did you evaluate and break down the market, I guess? And what excited you so much then, when it wasn't the obvious market that it is today?
Yeah, this was both an issue for the New Relic investment as much as the Wiley investment. And the category, APM, fell into the damned bucket of developer tooling. The conventional wisdom at the time, also when I invested in Wiley in 2001, was that developer tooling would never leave a significant business because, you know, they all tap out at about $50 million in revenue. And there were plenty of examples of that, of dev tools that Borland had acquired or CA had acquired that tapped out. And I think so much of the art of early stage venture is to ask the question of, can you unlock consumption? Can you tap into a latent potential energy of demand that can be made kinetic through a product experience that's radically easier to engage with and more immediately convincing minute zero, minute one, than it is in its current form? So the theory behind APM, Application Performance Management, was that there were billions and billions of dollars of software written every year. They were going into the world and torturing their users, either by slow response times, you have everything from lag to brownouts to full blackouts of sites going down, and that developers were being blocked from seeing that in the world. And the idea behind APM, back to Wiley, was we can give people the consciousness, the awareness of how their products do in the wild. And I think every developer has that sense of like, how's it going, and not knowing, and that fear that comes with that, these products address. So when we invested, it was a tiny market. You know, Wiley had been the market leader and maybe was doing $200 million in revenue. And the debate at the partner meeting was, can this ever be a significant company? Could it ever get to $100 million in revenue? Now, New Relic is approaching $1 billion. Certainly the category supports much more than that. And it came down to that basic question, which is, are we unlocking potential energy? And is that potential energy going to be able to allow us to monetize and build an economic model when it's made kinetic through the product experiences of New Relic? The second major variable in the investment was, in any of these market segments, there needs to be an outside force, in my experience, something you don't create, you know, an energy source that's bigger than a startup. And that, in this case, was Ruby on Rails. And what had led Lou to want to start the company was the joy and delight he had from creating Rails applications. And he recognized that that would provide 10 to 100x of increased scale of developers creating great applications, and that they would need these tools to be able to see into them and monitor them, manage them. And so the confluence of those two things of New Relic as a radically easier way to get APM through a cloud-delivered, simple deployment, up and running in 5 minutes, combined with this, at the time, what felt like galactic force of Ruby on Rails, led me to say that market could be really big one day. And it's sufficiently small today that there's no one in it, and it's immeasurably tiny. I remember the first customers when we did our Series B financing were companies like sheetmusic.com and PB Wiki. There was this question of like, how do you ever build a big business with customers like that, that are spending $500 a year with you? And now we look back, of course, and see it was sort of obvious in hindsight that this category was quite large, had a ton of energy that needed to be released through the creation of a product that would allow developers to get this joy of being able to see how their products did in the wild.
Can I ask, when you talk about the kind of the kinetic energy there, when you think about that transition in terms of the product experience, is that a gradual transition, or is that actually quite a sudden product update that causes a momentary shift in terms of that transition to kinetic energy?
I think the great products are gut punch, where you just say, wow, I can't unsee that. And it goes from like the consumer experience we used to talk about, pay at the pump, right? But that was the kind of feeling you had when you ordered your first Uber. And certainly the feeling that I think developers have when they deployed New Relic on a Rails application. I remember the conversation with Toby, and his eyes sparkled and said, this product is magical. What it allows our developers to get access to and see versus the alternatives, which are so radically deficient compared to the gut punch feeling of one of these great product inventions. So the beginning of New Relic was that visceral. It was that immediate. Now, that didn't mean it served every market. In fact, it was very narrowly constrained to the Rails market, to Ruby on Rails and the virtual machine that it ran with. And so what then became an issue of, okay, how do you, once you have that gut punch, how do you spread that to as big a population as possible over time without losing the immediacy of that product experience as you push out into Java, into Python, into PHP. And we debated all these different directions we could go. What we didn't debate is that the gut feel, you know, gut punch sort of product joy had to be primary in the experience of the developer versus the current market that they were competing in, where it took you a minimum of 3 weeks to be able to have your first instrumented application. And when we got it, it was so complicated and you know what you're looking at. And the New Relic grand simplification, I think you see this at other companies like Airtable, for me, is a great example of a grand simplification of the database. And to be able to have that gut punch of like, once you've done it, you can't unsee it. And any other approach feels so inadequate to that new high bar. And that is the hallmark, I think, of companies that can go from a product momentary lightning bolt into a big business, is they don't lose sight of that primary emotional feeling that you have when you use a product for the first time.
The challenge that I often face when I'm looking at that and product experiences like this is absolutely you have that gut punch, but it's the market timing question on adoption. How do you think about the dangers of market timing risk, even when you have that kind of transformational product experience for the consumer?
Market timing typically relates to adoption forces, right? So you're asking the question of, will the pull, not you're screaming at the market, but the market grabbing at your products, be there? And there usually are antecedents, right? Preconditions for that market pull to fall into place. In the case of New Relic, we needed the cloud. We needed Ruby on Rails. we needed over time, you know, the move to cloud AWS and Microsoft deployments. Those were beyond our control. But we set the company up. If you look at the Series A, there were four people. Now, of course, we committed to Lou when it was just Lou. And we managed our headcount and our expense load to be able to respond to the market forces without getting in front of them. And I think one of the bigger risks that's going on in 2021 is there's a lot of invested capitalists going into market preconditions that either don't exist or are still too early to support the economic development of the businesses. And so that was very conscious in 2007, 2008 for us, because we were going into the global financial crisis and we thought, okay, this is a terrible time to be trying to start a company. But by keeping it relatively tight, then allowed us to add and compound when those market forces became more visible. So market timing question was, will people want to ever have APM delivered in a cloud service? Back then, it was a real question. You go to banks, they would say categorically, no, we don't want our application data sitting in a third-party service. But you go to people like sheetmusic.com, they don't care. They're happy to have it in a cloud service because that means that's one less person they have to hire and one less system they have to manage. So those preconditions started to compound at an accelerating rate through the beginning part of the last decade to the point now where they seem obvious. But that is the market timing question. And it just gets to capital allocation and intensity of investment so that in a perfect market, it should happen, but not so quickly. Because if it happens all overnight, then it's really difficult to get the product to keep up with that. But if it happens too slowly, then you can run into a situation where you've overcapitalized it.
I mean, speaking of capital allocation and comparing to today, it was interesting when I had Bill on the show the first time, not with Howard Marks, but solo. He said that his biggest challenge today is the oversupply of capital. Would you agree with Bill there? And, you know, bluntly, I'm very nervous about it. Would you agree with Peter and me in terms of the concern and the nerves around the oversupply?
No, I don't have that same fear. I personally think that oversupply of capital is historically a good thing for innovation insofar as it creates higher degrees of entropy. Therefore, you have more random mutations, if you think about it in a biological sense, for things that might not otherwise have been possible to become possible. The confluence of variables to create a compelling product experience in many ways are non-deterministic, and they come from experimentation. And so when you have more capital, you have more experimentation. The pernicious effects of too much capital, I think, show up principally in the later stages of a company's life, where you get categories that get flooded with capital, and then that could, in fact, lead to uneconomic business models that aren't sustainable. But then the flip side of that is they also allow for foundations to be built that enable businesses that wouldn't otherwise be possible. So I think a lot of what's gone on, say, for example, local delivery and local businesses required an overabundance of capital to be able to create the critical mass to support high cash flow businesses. And so I don't think it's so black and white easy. The stage of capital that you're in, it matters intensely. And so right now we're, of course, you know, so far down the path of a 15, 16 year, one would say, bull market, that there are weird perversions that we'll look back in hindsight and say were enabled by the easy access to capital. But that doesn't mean innovation is being suffered or killed or suppressed. I think it only elevates with more energy.
Totally agree with you in terms of the acceleration around innovation. I mean, one interesting thing is, you know, although brilliant for innovation, for venture multiples, with the increase in price, you see the denigration of venture multiples to what could be, some suggest, like PE multiples. How do you feel about that in particular? I'm intrigued.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the New Relic example as a good A-B test today versus New Relic in 2007 when we made this commitment. And I'm just looking at the spreadsheet of our financial commitment. We put $3.25 million in to buy 27% of the company with a 20% management pool. That's a Series A investment. There was no seed, there was no pre-seed. And when the company went public, I don't have the exact numbers, but I think it was over $1 billion valuation and went up from there. What would that look like today? That 3.25 probably looks more like 7 to 10. And the ownership that the venture firm would buy would be historically lower than the 27%. But if you zoom out, Harry, big picture, if the company works, if it really works, it doesn't matter. And I think one of the mistakes we make on valuation discussions for early stage venture is false precision, of course, around is it worth this, is it worth that? And not enough conversations about does the character of the market and the entrepreneur allow us to imagine radical success and go pursue that with the right discipline day to day. If you're grandiose about it and overly big idea centric, you can do a belly flop, which we all know. But I think in the case of New Relic, where we had a debate in the benchmark partnership was, you know, that classic question of how big does this get? And I took the agnostic view of, we don't know, but we know there's a lot of software written every year that would benefit from APM. And if we can fix the distribution problem this market has had, which is it's too complicated to sell it and deploy it and make that easy, that we don't know what the limits are around this market size. And I don't think anybody would have predicted the scale that this market would grow to. And that gets back to the Series A's that are being done today. My bigger concern is that there's a lot of confusion around what people are doing for their first investment. And I happen to be perhaps a traditionalist in this. I think you're, as an entrepreneur, well served to form a primary relationship with a partner in the decade-long journey you're going on. And in the case of New Relic, I was on that board for 12 years. That's a pretty standard commitment for us. And what does that mean? It means going through the life cycle when they had one employee, and I left, I think they had 3,000 employees, the state changes that occur by having a durable, committed investor, how much of your company are you willing to part with for that relationship? And know that the company's likely going to have one primary long-standing venture relationship. What I think you run into now is there's more atomization or fracture in the cap tables around those primary relationships. And so maybe pre-seed, seed, and then a Series A. And in many cases, I think you can work backwards instead from how do I get the best partnership with a partner that also happens to be, you know, the largest investor, and then set the system up for that level of success. So put another way, if you don't have that principal partner, but you have a bunch of firms that have invested, but nobody who has that kind of psychic commitment to you and deep personal bond, I think you end up having a far less fulfilling relationship with your support system in that case than you would if you had a principal partner who you really do have that long-term relationship with.
I totally agree with you in terms of the importance of that long-term relationship. I mean, when we think of that in relation to your board participation, one thing I'd love to hear is, like, when you think about the incredible 12-year journey you had on the New Relic board, how do you think that experience in particular changed how you think about great board management? And this could be from the founder perspective in terms of how Lou managed the board so efficiently, or from your own perspective in terms of what it takes to be a great, great board member.
The original New Relic board stabilized at about three people for, I want to say, the first 5 years. I think we're accountable to the fact that it wasn't diverse. It was Lou, myself, and Dan from, at the time, Trinity Ventures. Yet there was something that I think was elusive in the dynamic, and to me, precious, around a very transparent, honest, and direct set of conversations about the state of the business. We didn't sit through PowerPoint slides, and I've talked about the power of having written narratives. The unsung hero of New Relic's financial success is Mark Sachleben, the CFO, who Lou brought in early. And Mark would write a crisp, succinct narrative with the team that laid out the core business metrics with the story behind them. We were able to, as issues surfaced in our consciousness, management team scaling, pricing pressure, competitive dynamics, have a very fluid conversation that felt like you were talking to not just people who had context and expertise, but that would stretch your thinking. And I think the really great boards, you come out and think, I wouldn't have thought about that if we hadn't had that conversation. So one of the things that I think we maintained through our addition of Sarah Fryer, who joined the board, Peter Curry, was that core culture of just being really direct and making it safe to be vulnerable, which is the key thing for Lou. The other thing we did, and I think this is an important lesson for entrepreneurs that are listening to this, Lou was a second-time entrepreneur. And so he didn't go to that second journey thinking, I'm going to prove all those people wrong. And instead, he took the mindset of, how do I do it differently? What do I want to learn from what I did last time that I could do better? And Lou was very admittedly conflict avoidant. He said, this is one of my issues. I need you guys as my partners to be on the watch for when I'm doing that. If you sense me avoiding conflict with a management team member or a problem in the business, call me out on it. It allowed us to make some changes in the early organizational structure that I think would have been delayed by at least 2 years in Lou 1.0. Lou 2.0 moved faster than I would have moved. And that was like in a matter of weeks, as opposed to what would have taken years, because that trust was there and the vulnerability was there and we could have those conversations. So I think the great boards are not an individual that is domineering in the boardroom, either the CEO or another director, but there's something that feels like creating music where the interplay of the different voices leads to something that comes together in a beautiful way to elevate the collective intelligence of what's going on in the business and what do we do.
You said about cooling out there. One thing that I struggle with, honestly, sitting on boards today, Peter, is like, do you cool out in the board meeting and then have a constructive discussion around it with the great minds that you have around the table? Or do you actually go, this may be challenging for the founder to face having not prepared, but I don't want to put him on the spot in a certain way. How do you think about cooling someone out or a founder out effectively?
Well, I think we underestimate the social emotional nature of any discourse, because I think we're humans at the end of the day, and we have natural emotional responses to critique. We get defensive. If you're threatened and the emotions of fear take over, you're not going to hear the feedback. You may hear it an hour later or a day later or a month later, but in the moment, the human response to critique is defense. And it takes a highly evolved founder to say, thank you for that criticism. So I think a huge part of doing our work is to be able to separate out the emotional reality of the moment, which is these people have killed themselves to create this board material. They're working their asses off every day. And we come in, and if we're full of critique, and believe me, this is a line I fear I've crossed one too many times, then it not only won't be heard, which means it's not effective feedback, but it can damage the ability to have a trust-based relationship. So a huge part of getting it right is something you can take out of the parenting books. I don't think it's discipline, but I do think it's, you start with validation, and you have to, in any situation, if something's gone off or you think that we're not talking about a big issue, you need to validate the emotional space that the team is in a very real way. And so it's not just platitudes, but then I think you earn the right by validating that, like, this is hard. And I feel like we may have missed something here. Not to say you guys aren't doing your best in many ways. And I see how you might see that you haven't missed something, but let me offer this up. So that extra work, you want to call it extra work, to create the conditions of healthy feedback dynamics is vitally important to have a functioning board. And you either end up in two bad outcomes in my experience in boards. There's the board that's passive aggressive, that doesn't really say anything in the moment, but then talks behind the founder's back. And I abhor that because to me, that's an accepting a learned helplessness around relational failure. The other end of the spectrum is aggressive, which is these people are just coming at us nonstop and they're beating us up. And I've had interesting board dynamics over my years as being an investor where team members come to me and say, God, you guys are really tough on us. And other teams that come to me and say, why aren't you harder on us? Like, you let us get away with bloody murder. Can't you elevate the level of accountability? So striking that balance, I think, is to say there's a sense of social emotional connection, validation of the struggles that might be hard, and then a use of really constructive language. The one thing, this is, I don't know, we have time for this in the podcast, but one of my closest confidants got me a copy of Marshall Rosenberg's book, Nonviolent Communication. Yeah. And I want to give that to everybody. I did for a while. I need to continue to buy copies of it and pass it around. But I think the idea of feedback as an art, and by the way, and I should also say, when you're giving feedback, you may not be right. So you have to be careful when you give your feedback to leave sufficient space to be wrong. But when you're giving that feedback, to do it in a way where it can be received with maximum clarity and constructive tone requires constant vigilance and practice.
Well, that was going to be my question to you, which is, like, bluntly, the weight of your words today, Peter, are incredibly meaningful for any founding team, for any board. How do you think about caveating the weight of your words so that people don't simply act on them? Because as you said, you know, it's not always going to be right. It's just input. So how do you think about caveating the weight of your words to prevent that being the right way to do it for the founder?
I think it starts with a bit of an oath that you take where, what is your responsibility on the board in terms of impacting the outcome of the business and the quality of the business, the rigor and the probability of success? If you think your role is to provide the answers, then I think you probably shouldn't be in the boardroom. And there are times when you feel that way, when you see something with such clarity, this is the wrong VP of sales, this is the wrong pricing structure. And when you feel those instincts to give the answer, you're dishonoring the relationship. And I think that those moments require you to pull back and say, if I trust the entrepreneur and their critical thinking skills, are they asking the questions, the appropriate questions to get to the right answer? And so if you do take a step back from answer giving to question asking, and you have faith in the entrepreneur, they'll get there. That takes longer at times because it may be easy just to say, hey, this is the wrong leader for this role. But instead say, what are the expectations of this role? And have you made those explicit? And what confidence do you have they're going to be achieved? And so much of what you end up doing in that case is unlocking the capabilities of the organization as opposed to scripting it. And I think most directors fail at this. I have failed at this multiple times and I will continue to fail at it because it's sometimes a lot easier just to give the answer. And it takes longer to ask the questions and frame it in the right way, but I think it's far more durable in terms of impact on the board. So that being said, you will find no shortage of examples of me having an answer and giving it. But I really, I have to say, I'm very receptive and encourage and demand my boards give me feedback if my perspective is overly deterministic and not sufficiently Socratic.
Can I ask one final thing before the quick fire, Peter? And it's like, you know, I think most of the venture world bluntly looks at you in a form of deity, given all the success and the incredible achievements you've had. I'm very much leaning, and we spoke about vulnerability earlier. When you think about your own self-vulnerability and attitude towards it, what are you vulnerable around yourself? I'm just intrigued, given kind of the deity around your brand and providing a bit of humanity to that as well.
Well, I remember something that someone might think the world of, Mike Moritz, said, which is the minute you figure this big business out, you're done. I don't think I have superficial humility. I really genuinely believe that this is a craft that gets practiced every day. The minute you think that you figured it out and that you've mastered it, you've shut down your capacity to do it effectively. So I have a deep and genuine sense of, I am no better than, I assure you I'm not, than anyone else practicing this business on any given day. It just depends how I show up in my capabilities and capacities mapped to the problem in front of me and the opportunity in front of me. So that vulnerability means that I'm able to say with high confidence that I make numerous mistakes in any given workday on the perspectives that I have. And I think by being receptive to where I'm getting it wrong, in a sense, it's recursive. It allows, I think, me to model behavior for the people I work with to say that is not only okay, it's part of growth, is that you're in that continual, how could I do better? What might I be missing here? And when you're asking those questions, you then raise the bar on your own internal sense of getting better and what that looks like, but also for the people you work with. Yes, at times we may seek security, but I think there's deep wisdom and insecurity in a healthy way of saying none of this is durable. Benchmark won't be around in 50 to 75 years, nor will most of the companies we work with. And that's okay, but we shouldn't attach ourselves to some egoic sense of who we are. We should attach to the joy we have in doing our work every day. And that should provide a chance for growth.
I do want to dive into my favorite though, which is the quick fire. So I say a short statement, Peter, and then you give me your immediate thoughts. Are you ready to rock and roll?
I'm ready.
Going back to New Relic, what was your pre-mortem on the reasons why it might not work?
The reasons it wouldn't work, tiny market of Mickey Mouse developers that would never have the money to support a viable economic model.
What was your theory on what New Relic could be if all the stars aligned as they have done?
Conscious software, which isn't to say AI, but software that would have, wherever code was written, the ability to have awareness for the people who wrote it in the wild. And so when you think about the scale, why not stop or why not imagine all of software being visible in the wild to the people who wrote it? And that would elevate our collective accountability to writing great software and people enjoying the creations without all the suffering of slow, unresponsive, or buggy code.
If you were to choose one thing above anything else that drove New Relic's success, what do you think it would be? And I know that's an incredibly hard one.
I think sustained commitment to product invention and innovation unlocked its continual growth, where we struggled in the business when that engine wasn't firing on its full potential. I think Lou has reinvigorated that, but it's that sustained commitment to the invention and the wow feeling of the gut punch, if you will, of the product in the developer's lived experience of it.
Penultimate one, who's the unsung hero from the New Relic team and what did they do behind the scenes?
Mark Zaklavin, without question, to me is the unsung hero. Egoless, connective tissue, elevated at every point in the company's evolution, awareness around what mattered most. And he carried the title of CFO, but he was far more than that, confidant, trusted advisor. And never once did you feel any drip of political agenda in him.
Final one, Peter. What's your favorite story from working with New Relic in the incredible 12, 13-year journey that it was now?
It's hard to distill that many experiences over that many years. I do think the moment that I remember most in hindsight was in the middle of financial crisis, 2009, we started missing our number. And I felt in one of those moments in a career where all the stars align, where you have a sense for serving a purpose that you're uniquely able to serve. And Lou had come to the board meeting really down, not sure of what it could become. And we were probably at $3 or $4 million in revenue. So it wasn't very big to be slowing down. To breathe confidence into that room, into Lou, into the business to get through that trough. And that board meeting, he came out and I think felt uplifted by our support for him. And in a sense, it prevented a spiral of psychology around we weren't going to be great and elevated us back to the upwards virtuous cycle. I think that that sort of durable commitment is what defines the role we like to play.
Peter, as always, I learned so much from our discussions and I so enjoyed this one, as I always do. So thank you so much for joining me today. And this has been such a pleasure to do.
Always a thrill, Harry. Thank you for creating the space to do this great work.
I have to say, I'm so envious when I hear Peter speak. The clarity and precision with which Peter speaks is just incredible. I can't thank Peter enough for giving up his time today to be on the show. If you'd like to see more from us, you can find more on the site at the20minutevc.com, where you can also sign up to the newsletter. But before we leave you today, I have to say, I just love using AngelList's fund admin platform to manage my investments. The team and platform at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups. startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of amazing products there with AngelList, last month I had Jeff Seibert and Wayne Chang on the show from Digits. Simply put, they're two of the best founders I've met, and they're creating the most intuitive financial software you've ever used, automatically analyzing your company's spend and visualizing it for you as it happens. Hone in on recent activities, trends, anomalies, or any question you have in just a few clicks. And unlike every other financial software, their integration is not weeks, it is just a few clicks. I have to say the product is just beautiful and you have to check it out, and so you can do that on digits.com. And finally, I've always been a big history man, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com, check out CooleyGo.com also.
As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I cannot wait to bring you a very special episode this coming Thursday.